Welcome to What Women Want with Amy Annette. Hello and welcome to the show, What Women Want, where I and some great comedians look at the misadventures, misunderstandings and misogyny involved in being a woman. Consider this your podcast equivalent of your one friend who you trust enough to share your darkest misadventures with. Misadventures like, for example, this week I ordered two burgers to take away, and I may have got one with no cheese to sort of make it seem like one was for someone else. I'm fine. In this episode, we are looking at what women want is self-care. We recorded the show back in March 2018 at the Soho Theatre. I'm joined by three of the smartest people I know. I actually remember enjoying listening to them so much I had to remind myself I was on stage too. Let's join Sarah Pascoe, Rose Matafeo and Jack Rook to find out what women want.
Nice to see you all. To actually see you is lovely. How are you doing?
Very good. Very well. I just ate a lot of popcorn though, so I'm so sorry. I've got
dry.
A lot of them in the teeth. So I'm just going to do the whole show like that. Hope you enjoy this.
Sarah bought vegan donuts and I'm never eating chicken again.
That's how we get you.
You just always
just
eat
up,
vegan
guys,
donuts.
I just happened to bring some donuts with me.
And pamphlets.
Pamphlets are inside, they open up in your stomach.
The idea is that each time we have a different topic to start us off. And today, and I told these guys in advance, we're going to be talking about what women want is self-care. How do we feel about self-care?
Yeah.
Lovely. Self-care, I believe, and what I think you'll come hopefully to believe with me at the end, is really important. But obviously it does have this sort of sense that is just bath bombs, right? Like there is a small percentage of people who think it is just bath bombs. A side note, I do not understand bath bombs. Anyone here like bath bombs?
Have you heard Bridget Christie's new radio show? Because her first episode, I mean, you should just do it anyway, because it's fantastic. But the first episode, it's almost a bit like it's sponsored by Lush. No, except she keeps complaining about how they irritate her anus.
San Diego. Aren't they quite like... Actually, I've never had a bath. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have just jumped in there with a... Yeah, baths are very sandy, aren't they? I'm having the weirdest type of bath. I'm having a bird bath. The bath bombs can be gritty. Yeah. Get up in there.
I once dated a guy who worked in Lush, and it was great for a while, until we started seeing each other all the time. And the smell seeped into the skin and made me feel sick, and then he irritated my arse. No.
It's exactly the sort of chat you have with your friends. I think I have this, I mean, I'm going to listen to this radio show because I didn't realize it was my anus that I was worried about, but I guess that's what I'm fearing about. Because my self-care to reveal to you is very sincere American podcasts. There's one called How I Built This with Guy Raz. And Guy Raz talks like this and he can't believe what he's hearing. He can't believe it. So it's sort of like Cheryl, the guy who created Starbucks is like, yeah, and then I just thought coffee. And he's like, you just thought coffee? And the guy's like, right. It's so charming. I love it. I really recommend you listen to it. You walk away. I now have to stop myself doing this podcast like that. Like, your anus? What? Oh, God. American sincerity is definitely my sort of self-care. But so the idea is that we'll each briefly talk about what self-care means to us, and then I'm going to ask these guys some questions, and then that's it. And then, we're going to be done by 5:30. I mean, that is the dream, isn't it? You could be in bed by 9. Yes, comedy as on my terms. I love it. So for me, self-care means, I don't know, to be sincere about it for a second in an American way, it sort of strikes a sort of gap that I have between how I think about feminism and act with feminism, act as a woman, think as a woman, and how I actually internalize it and sort of use it on myself, if that makes sense. Like for me, I think a lot about how it is to be a woman in this world. Like the show has really helped me do that, but I still don't always apply those things to myself. I think the word self is a really interesting thing in self-care. an idea of who you are within sort of activism, if that's what you do, or even just within your life. It's very hard, and it's almost embarrassing sometimes to think about yourself in those terms. I don't know if it's an English thing in particular, but the idea that you would ever prioritize yourself is a hugely... It brings about this sort of English, like, oh, no, the dogs should eat before me. Let the children wash, I shall wait. Like, I don't know, I don't have English parents, and I think that shows. So I've been thinking a lot about how my personal self-care is, and I think a lot of it comes down to how I actualize what I say and do in my real life about other people for myself. And so there's a quote that you will always hear, because it's a great quote, from Audre Lorde about self-care, which is that self-care is an act of self-preservation, and therefore it's an act of warfare. And I mean, Audre Lorde obviously was an American poet, a black woman, and she used to call herself very invisible. And so the idea that someone who's in a marginalized group might then say, no, I'm worth something, myself is something other than the labels you put on me, is obviously incredibly powerful. And so therefore, sometimes when you hear self-care talked about in those terms, and then you hear self-care talked about in terms of how many embroidery hoops have you done this week, there's a sort of disconnect there. But I would argue that it's a wide net, and we should all feel like we can sit within it. And I think culturally, we sort of shy away from thinking about how self-care should help us change things. So much about self and feminism nowadays often is like, guys, if you could just be a bit more confident, that'd be great. Like, if you could just lean in a little more, like if you could just like get over all the systemic obstacles in your way by just being a bit more gung-ho. And so with that vision in my mind, I'd like to pass over to you guys. Sarah, what did you think of when you heard the topic with self-care?
I really worried because hearing you explain self-care makes me obviously understand it in a different way. For me, it's something that feels very... So just my instant vision of it is very middle class, and it's very commercialized. Mm-hmm. I hear the term self-care when someone is trying to sell me something I don't need, or when they are trying to tell me that... actually, I think it's like a softener. It's like, no, don't change the system.
Mm.
Have a nice bath. you won't want to smash the patriarchy when you've had a bit of a relax. Your scented soft lavender pillow. And I think there's lots of reasons I struggle with it. I think not in terms of the self thing. I understand like ego and individual. I think knowing where your edges are, reminding yourself who you are, and that doesn't mean necessarily being part of something as huge as a spectrum of gender or a political belief. I think quite often we're in gangs and groups and we think they define us in ways that they don't. They don't come close to it. So I think that area is quite interesting. But the care bit makes me feel, my instant thing is that it's greedy and selfish, and that too much introspection. The people who are the most introspective quite often who... okay, so here's a cliche. I've never been to America, so I don't know this. I've not seen it. My idea of what LA is everyone going, I'm very unhappy, I'm going to self-care. And they don't realize this vicious cycle of caring for themselves is why they're unhappy. They're isolated. Do you think that's too harsh? No, because I honestly feel like... So I've been reading all these books about economic... disparity, right? And it says that the reason that depression gets higher the more with the more economically privileged is because they're isolated, which isn't to say it's great to be poor because you have to go next door and borrow sugar because you can't afford any. But essentially what it says is when you have to share, extended family are far more interreliant and interdependent, with children, lots of people passing the kids around. That's the kind of family. My mum's one of seven, my dad's one of nine, both like poor families, but not poor in terms of no one ever didn't have anything because someone else sorted it out. Like my dad, still now, his brothers and sisters lives in Australia, they pay for him to come over when he is, sort him out a bit of gardening, do a bit of that. Like there's this whole mentality of sharing, whereas it's really, really fascinating. I think sometimes we can look introspectively when actually what we need is to think about someone that's not us. That is not to say that will always solve the problem. I'm so aware, if you are depressed, I'm not saying, oh, you're selfish. That's not what I'm saying. But sometimes going, all of the neurotransmitters you get from being part of a team or sharing are the things that you lack. And so serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin, like things like singing in a choir, they do these experiments and people's happiness goes through the roof. You don't have to be good at singing. It's the fact that you're in a group of people doing something that's so primal. And probably that is truly termed self-care. Mm. But because I see this really capitalist vision of it, my instant thing is to shirk away from it. My mum's the kind of person, if you were ever sad, and obviously you can legitimately be sad, but my mum would just say all through her childhood, there's children in Africa who are starving. And I still have that. And sometimes it's really helpful to remember, I think it's really important to take care of ourselves, but sometimes the way of doing that might be ignoring myself for a little bit. I do have everything I need. I can be with other people.
Yeah.
Help other people.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you.
I completely can. That is kind of similar to what I want to preface this with the fact that I am a really an outspoken supporter of low self-esteem. So I think it's a great energy to work with as a woman. I think you get shit done. I think it's a real good fire up your ass, up your ass, under your ass. Let's edit that out. But genuinely, that's so interesting what you say in terms of, that's exactly how I kind of respond to it as well. It feels like a self-care is a very Instagram-y thing to me sometimes, where I'm like, I go down, I've got a dark web of Instagram hate follows that I follow who are exactly like that. It's very much taking care of yourself, and then you're like, what are you doing for your, I guess, community? I think in self-care, what I have kind of maybe interpreted it in a way that I can kind of deal with it is just, as you get old, year by year, as you get older, just figuring out what makes you happy, in the sense that what you can say no to, I think. Mm. And it's like, it is the thing, is just like, I want to stay home. I don't want to go to a party. I want to stay home and I want to do a jigsaw. I want to, it's those choices, that you make to go, I am going to preserve myself or make myself kind of the most happiest version I can of myself. But, and I think this is exactly what you're saying, Sarah, and I totally agree, is that you're building yourself up to be a person who can then kind of reflect that energy outwards. Mm. Because if it's all inwards, then you're kind of making a 2.0 or a 3.0 of a version that's not like upgrading to a alpha version, you know what I mean? Of something that can kind of do more caring. Because caring is a good thing. Like, caring is often, like, as you say, like emotional labor, like, women are often expected to care for people. But caring is something that is like good for your heart. Like, you know what I mean? And like, it makes you feel good and makes you into a better person. So I think the obsession with kind of like caring for yourself over other people, it's not over other people, it's perhaps before other people, and so that you can serve others in a better way. So, I mean, I'm talking all this crap. Like, I talk all this crap, but like, I don't think I do enough as well to help people around me and I guess communities that are outside of my kind of bubble as well. But I do see it when I see, I'll just see, oh my God, I've watched some, I mean, I follow some horrible people on Instagram. I know. And it's really bad. It is bad for my soul, but in a way it is a good reminder of what I don't potentially want to be. And that is to be a bit more self-aware about that kind of stuff and to hold myself accountable of what I am and what I'm not doing as a person who lives in the world. So care for yourself, but also, go to a charity sausage sizzle or something and help out. Do you guys have sausage sizzle here? I don't know. It's basically you make sausages. It's a New Zealand thing. Move on.
I was clapping the sausage sizzle.
Thank you. Let's get it. Let's get it.
Apparently there's like a hardware shop in Australia and New Zealand where they like
Bunnings.
I heard this the other day and I was like, IKEA meatballs, I'm done. Like,
wait,
I want
so it's a hardware
sausages.
Store where they sell sausages?
No, you can, charities and organisations can like, but like rent them barbecue and do sausages like every weekend. Yeah.
Self-care, baby. Hardware, tools, sausage.
I once nearly got hit by a bus because I parked up right outside of Bunnings to run in and get like, it was not a drive-through situation, but it was a bus lane. But yeah, to run in and get some sausages was fantastic.
Great.
Thank you, Rose. That's great.
Oh, thanks.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you were saying that thing about 2.0, 3.0, Alpha, I was like, this is the most millennial thing I have ever heard anyone say. Guys, we just got to be 2.0.
We got to be Mac High Sierra, which I have not upgraded to because it's too much gigs.
Internet.
I sort of feel like, yeah, my thing when I hear about self-care, and I suppose it sort of resonates with both what you've said, is that, like, we before me mentality. So, like, I think class is definitely a huge thing. The self-care industry is sort of like, it exists so much in paper chase and, like, in very little shops that you're going to get, like, in places where people could do with, like, oh, I'm about a book and it's me just putting everything that I've ever written in and it costs me £20. And, you know, it's like paper will do. But yeah, I think it made me think a lot about my mum. So my mum is an amazing woman. She's a sort of like working class grafter. She's in her 60s now, and self-care just isn't on her remit, really. And I've tried to, as I've sort of like developed a bit of a job talking a lot about mental health and trying to sort of help people, I've tried to sort of be like, mum, why don't you, you know, relax, why don't you do stuff? And she's like, do you want a sandwich? But mum, why don't you just chill, watch Poldark? And then she's finished watching Poldark and then she's like trying to do everything else for everyone. And it's like, I'm not trying to say that, you know, I like mum making me a sandwich all the time. But like, that seems to be what really like spurs her on, is that like group mentality. If everyone else is okay, then I'm all right. And trying to sort of think about it, the only times that I can really remember me and my mum really indulging in self-care was when my dad died and I was about 15 and she was about mid-50s, and we went on this like self-care campaign, but that was just driven out of like, if we don't look after each other and ourselves, then there is nothing else. You get to that like base level where you just have to, like the smallest step is getting out of bed and then it's making toast and doing whatever. But then it just sort of spiraled to that self-care was just like, yeah, we will get Tracy, who makes the good lasagnas, to come around next week, because she will make us that lasagna because she feels sorry for us, and we will eat and it will be good. Like, sort of I just sort of like clap your 16-year-old grief-stricken self, because like, that was it. And so like, that's my only sort of like knowledge, is that actually really self-care for me always comes into my life or into my sort of vision, I think, when people need it the most, when people actually need to say no, stop. I think the last time that I really did it was sort of in September, where like I had a lot of, you know, work stuff on that was related to grief and mental health and suicide, and it was all so heavy. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm not a comedian anymore, I'm like a poster child for depression. And I was like, stop, I need to like chill out and go away. And that's when I discovered, and I don't mean to trivialize what I'm about to say, because it was like a weird year, but that's when I discovered my t-shirt, which is Broad City. Any Broad City fans here? Thank you. So I discovered Broad City, and all of a sudden I was like, why the fuck do I give a shit about anything that I don't want to not do? And so I got a bit far on the fandom, and I did pay £90 for this, shipped from Canada. But I think self-care...
I could have drawn you that on a £3 t-shirt.
It's basically Rose and Amy if she had a fringe on a t-shirt, which is great. But no, I think that's my sort of response to self-care, is that I think it's really important to know when you need it and to really indulge in it. But it doesn't have to be like the £1 million industry of, you know, like those sort of books and the kind of like clinical middle class stuff. It needs to be spread out a bit more and encouraged to people when they really need it.
And there's some things that are really sensible. Like, so I was thinking as you two are both speaking about things like exercising, which can sometimes feel like the psychology of doing it is, oh, I'm supposed to because I'm so fat. Like, when the idea of like, oh, it makes you feel so much better is really, and again, it is a time thing. You do have to be kind of like time rich to be able to kind of go for a swim or things like yoga, which I think really help. But I think sometimes I was thinking that actually I always think self-care is like, oh yeah, just eat the whole pizza. It's much more like, oh yeah.
But all the lasagnas. Yeah. You can get your hands on.
Thank you, Jack. It was great. Woo!
Thank you.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I thought we might come to that conclusion at the end of the show, but it's fine that we did it at the top. The like aspects of self-care are like, it's become sort of co-opted in this way, in a similar way, I think, to some in the ways that feminism has. Like, there are some media tactics about talking about self-care and mental health, which is not the same thing as self-care, but it's sort of sometimes lumped in together, that they sort of treat feminism with too. Like, you can buy self-care bath bombs. I'm sure you can buy feminist bath bombs.
Yeah, what like, were the, what were the non-self-care version of bath bombs?
Like, nails, like nails. Nails in them. Yeah.
Yeah, and blood, yeah.
Across the road in Wagamama, they, I've got some, oh no, I'm going to get like,
what?
No, it's just, I always go to Wagamama and then I'm always slagging it off behind its back. It's like all my aunties
why
and uncles.
Did you slag it off?
No, no, the only reason is because, I don't know, I actually don't know why I'm doing that. I'm just jealous, I'm jealous. Jealous. It's because they weirdly have this thing where like a couple of things on the menu, they like donate certain amounts to charity and they're always like a penny or whatever. But they've got one that's like the positive juice that is like, if you buy this juice, then 5p will go to like a mental health charity. And I'm like, it's just a juice, mate. There's like so many other juices and I get it and I get what it's there for. But I'm also like, sometimes it doesn't sit very well with me when there's like really obvious sort of corporate alignments.
I think the thing is, because it all adds up, but you're absolutely right, it's such a weird psychology. But imagine if they wrote there, this juice is £3, have a look at your life, mate. There's people sleeping on the streets. Like, I just wanted a juice.
But it's corporate virtue signaling though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, it's an easy way. It's an easy way to donate to charity and you don't have to.
But doesn't like, that make sense? Like, so much of our politics nowadays are led by brands. And, like, I find it so interesting how self-care and feminism have become these, like, they're brand identities now.
But that's because they're making money off it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so it doesn't happen because someone sits in an office and goes, what's next?
Yeah.
Companies follow things or mutate or change. It's, Sarah Brown's podcast, which is so amazing. I think the first one they were talking about how all companies now, basically graduates, are really, really altruistic and ethical, and they want to work and they want to be able to afford mortgages and have lives, but they also want to work for companies where they don't regret. They want to be able to know in their heart they're not making the world worse, which means that all of these companies now have departments that are more ethical, and they speak. So if, like, so BAE Systems, who make landmines, are carbon neutral. And they have a whole page on their website about, mate, carbon. We're the good guys. And it is, it's astonishing.
Wow.
But it is, it's driven by good things. But and also, again, when we think about human beings as an animal, when we have money, we derive pleasure from buying things. Mm. The whole thing about kind of, what's it used to be called? Before self-care, there was something therapy, retail therapy. That's what they used to say, which was the idea of like, I deserve it. I work hard. It's just like shoes you can't walk in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a real history of women being sold stuff and companies getting very clever about how they do it.
But, and always, because, so even like Betty Friedan talks about it, even like in the 50s, they thought that women were still, they weren't earning the money necessarily, but they were definitely in control of what was being bought at the supermarket. So all products were targeted, saying you will have a happier family if you buy this thing, whether it was a kind of a cleaning product or a turkey.
I have a ton of my mum's.
Or a landmine, but I don't know.
I have tons of my old mum's. I think I showed you them actually. My mum's 17 magazines from the late 70s and early 80s. And there is actually something. There is almost something more pure about like an ad for lipstick saying, "Put this on, you piece of shit." Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, or else you're gonna look nice if you put this on. All right, and it's kind of like way more upfront, and it's worse. But at least it's like not thinly veiled under something else.
Yeah,
you know,
it's basically
selling what
now
it is.
It's, when you feel good, you look good.
Yeah, yeah.
So why don't you put this lipstick and look good? And that might help you feel good.
100%.
Make you look good. there was a year, I think it was the year I did the Funny Women competition, and we were sponsored by a makeup brand that said, laughter is the best makeup.
Yeah.
But they sold makeup. That was their tagline.
Because they wouldn't be laughing at the gig. So, on comedy and how insane the comedy industry can be sometimes. So, as performers and comedians, like, a lot of stand-up can be about the self and how you fit into the world and how you see the world. And I wonder, do you feel like do you want to talk about how you see the world in your real life on stage? Is that something that you feel like is important to do? Or do you try to kind of keep things separate?
I feel massive guilt about talking about myself so much on stage, in the sense that when you see someone else like doing like political, Trump and stuff, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, they're really actively like, you know, changing. They're talking about important stuff. But then what I see it as, and I have tried to deal with it in the way of I'd say I do observational comedy. In the sense that I think a lot of comedians do that. They self-reflect to the point of condensing an observation down to its like most purest form. But I think the difference between certain comedians and other comedians is that it's literally how far you come to meet the audience. And it's this thing of like, when you're making a joke to make a connection with people, that you're making observations about yourself, which apply and are relatable to others. But there are other types of comedy that I don't like and I don't really want to do, which is sort of yelling what's happened to you and not seeing how you can connect to a crowd with that. You know what I mean?
How I would separate those two things is stand-up is an authored form, and I like that as a phrase for it, because that is where you come. Because I want to come and see your worldview. I want to see the world through your eyes. And sometimes that's because I want to see the world through Paul Foot's eyes. But I hate being lectured. So that's my distinction I'm absolutely fine for people to tell me things I don't understand. That's quite often, again, why I come to comedy. I can't live everyone's life. Someone's telling me about their life and their different approaches. And that's why it becomes boring when it's homogenous. There was this huge time where it was just kind of cis, able-bodied, middle-aged, fat white men talking about pies and how much they hate their wives. And it was... really boring, not because they weren't incredible craftspeople who were very good at crafting jokes, but there's something about, it's horrible to say man, and I shouldn't say man, a man. I'm trying to think, because I don't really, I can't think off the top of my head of a woman who does this, but I'm sure they do. But I was, it's a back of the throat kind of telling me about how the world works. And I think, you are a clown. Okay, you are one of life's failures. How dare you lecture me? Like, how dare you? And I want to switch off from it.
It's the most patronizing shit of all time. Yeah, it's the idea of like, am I making sense to you?
Yeah. And the idea that you've made people pay to come and watch you tell them you think we should have done about Brexit.
It's the it's the TED Talks paradox. Yeah. It's like, what line do you cross when you become? I mean, TED Talks are great, so I shouldn't be slamming them. But, and this show is basically a TED Talk, so I don't know what I'm doing. Stop talking about TED Talks. Okay. But there is that thing where it comes to the communication in the community that we were talking about earlier. Like, stand-up, when I love stand-up is when I can watch someone who is talking about something that I've never done before, but I can see myself within it. And the reason you can is because they're being so truthful about who they are that you go on that journey with them. And I think all three of you, I mean, you more than do that. And like Rose in particular, I was thinking about your IUD material recently. Oh,
yeah. Yeah,
just always thinking about IUDs. Yeah. I don't know what it stands for. Intrauterine
device.
It's contraception for those not in the know. I weirdly was about to try and do a version of your material, which is obviously the worst. So my favorite thing that you do is
the story about trying to get it put in, or the pill stuff, because I found a genuine, and it is the most immediate kind of example of that, in the sense that sometimes comedy, like I say, I think comedy is a transference of like energy, in the sense that you are giving something and someone's bouncing their back to you. And like after shows, oh my God, how many girls would come up to me. I have this joke about like the length of your period in my last show, about how I'm like a 5-dayer, which is like a classic length. And I've got like lots of friends who like have 3 days, and I'm like, fuck you. And like I had so many girls just coming up to me, not even saying hello, being like, going home with their friends and being like, 3 days, 5 days. This immediate like outpouring of like complete relate, like you're just connecting on in a way, because when you don't hear people speak about that kind of stuff, you know, it's, but then in a way I'd say it isolates dudes in my audience quite a lot.
Well, this is where the privilege thing comes in.
Yes.
Because the anger that's always existed about women in comedy, this idea that we just talk about our periods, when it happens very rarely. I think after Joe Brand didn't happen at all, because almost the thing that was whispered to you as you decided to be a comic was, don't talk about your periods, because then they'll just really use that against you.
Yeah.
And so we were actually for a long time nothing, because the opposite occurred. Men couldn't see themselves, or people in male bodies, or for whatever reason couldn't see themselves in the menstrual material, and so either they were conditioned to not hear anything about it and thought it was disgusting. They definitely thought, don't talk about a thing I don't know about.
Yeah.
And I have no interest in knowing about, even though half of the world is women.
Yeah.
Not interested.
But that is a tradition throughout all sort of creative things. Like, there's that stat about when men write books, they're read equally by men and women. And when women write books, men just don't read female books.
They don't. And also, but the same thing happens with comedy. I get told so often, even like, this is like, I'm being taken to New York for 2 months, right? And I had this West End run, and he came to see the show just to see what state it was in, because it's a promoter. And the first thing he said to me was, it's mainly a female audience. And he doesn't think that's insulting, but the way, what he's trying to say is, you don't appeal to men. And it says a lot of people, I get asked a lot, and are your audience mostly women? Because why would a man listen to you?
But also, I went to your West End run, very good, really great, and there was loads of dudes.
Well, I always think it's exactly mixed.
Yeah.
I've never come out and gone, oh God, I'm being too parochial. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, do you guys feel like you perform to a specific audience when you perform? Like, do you think that you have to play with what people expect of you as when they see you on stage?
Well, gigs are very different. So actually, there are gigs I get to and I go, oh, I can't do my normal stuff here. And there are gigs where you turn up, like I did on the 7th, I did a gig in Brighton. And so it was the day before International Women's Day, and it was billed by the Brighton Dome as an International Women's Day gig. And as I came out on stage, I was like, oh, this is like so my people. So I did have that thing of like defining, going, I already know they get it. And there are the opposite, where I get scared.
Yeah, but that's a form of self-care in itself, of self-preservation, yeah. of like, oh yeah, I'm not going to do my peri material at a club night on a Thursday.
Yeah. I had to do some awards for second-hand car salesman last week, and it really, 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 really was a terrible booking error.
yeah.
Yeah.
Jack, I wanted to ask you, you talk about mental health in your shows, or you have, not always, and you...
I think I have always.
I'm like, you love this, so... do you feel like a responsibility to tell a certain type of story, or do you feel like you're allowed to tell the story about yourself?
I don't know, I think it's an interesting one, because I sort of fell into being a performer through trying to write something that, well, I actually tried to make a documentary. So my actual origins of like becoming a sort of comedian, writer, performer were just because I ran out of money to make a documentary. And the Arts Council are very generous to people who like don't live in London and who are gay with a story. Like, that's it. And they were like, why don't you turn your films into a show and write a show? So like everything, I never sort of, it's taken me until the last sort of 2 to 3 years to really understand audiences, because I was just doing it and always surprised when people came and enjoyed it. But I think what I try to do is, or what I especially try to do with my sort of first show, is the thing that I always found really annoying when I watched a lot of stuff, especially sort of like things that were really autobiographical, is that people would speak about family members or whatever, but you would always hear them through their lens. Mm. So like with my first show, I had my nan in the show with me in loads of films and projections. And that was mainly because I just thought, I want people to see her and hear her voice and her experience of, you know, my first show was called Good Grief and it was about losing my dad, but it was sort of about how me and my nan used it to get what we wanted, aka self-care. And I wanted people to see her and actually like picture her and see her in her flat. And my nan was cool with it. She didn't really know, like my nan did not have a clue what it would be. When she asked me, she was like, and where do you want this to be? And I was like, well, my dream would be for it to be at Soho Theatre. And she was like, not the Palladium. And I was like, no. what I find particularly interesting is that my audience tends to be a mix, and it has changed actually in the last couple of years, probably because I've grown in awareness as an act. But I think sometimes I can tell guys that have come to see me because their girlfriends have dragged them there. Their girlfriends have thought, I really want you to see something that's about something emotional that men seem to typically struggle with because of the sort of boundaries and restrictions of masculinity. And then by the end of it, I'm always really chuffed when it's like the guys that are the first to come up to speak to me, because I feel way more comfortable performing in front of women, if I'm honest. I think it might just sort of be because of my material and sort of, I was trying not to say something really creepy then.
It's not creepy. There's a whole unspoken dialogue going on between men which can be kind of aggressive.
Mm.
And it doesn't happen in the same way. Which isn't to say women can't be aggressive, but the whole, you know, what's it like, kind of pecking order hierarchy.
Mm.
Men are working out how safe they are by going, are you alpha, am I beta? Because you're standing up as an alpha beta male, which is a strange space.
Yeah.
And I also think about that thing you say about the men coming to see you. I think they have to kind of pretend they don't want to be there. I think they do. I don't think they'd be there if they didn't want to be there.
Well, that's funny, because I was going to patronise these guys and be like, maybe there's some of them in the audience tonight. And then I was like, well, you know what? Let them be. You know, like, because that's not... I get dragged to see stuff and no one's ever like, but all the girlfriends have come to see this play. It's just not a thing, this idea that men aren't interested in that. It's so reductive.
I think it's probably, you know, me getting over that like self-deprecation now, that I think there are like guys that really resonate with what I'm saying. But what's really interesting is that I sort of have tried to look into sort of the ways that actually it can't just be like just me speaking and performing, the ways that actually men can like learn from certain aspects of talking about stuff. And there's a festival that goes on at the South Bank Centre called Being a Man Festival, which is like sort of masculine version of Women of the World. And what's really interesting is that more women go to Being a Man than men do. And I've always found that really interesting. I think it's just about petering out now, like more and more men are coming each year. But I wrote about this recently in this article. I think that women are really, really overlooked and actually quite responsible for the recent change in looking at masculinity. I don't think it's necessarily, I think the way it's sort of painted out is because so many men are sort of at the forefront of this like toxic masculinity, looking at male mental health topic that's very much in the zeitgeist. I think a lot of it is actually really driven by feminism. And I work for a charity called Calm, which stands for the Campaign Against Living Miserably. And it was set up by a woman called Jane Powell, who is an amazing activist and feminist. She was on Greenham Common. Like, she's an incredible woman. And her whole sort of theory about it, and this was about, you know, 10 years ago, was that if you sort out what is so toxic about masculinity, that will benefit both genders. Like, if we figure out why it is that so many men seemingly tend to be more likely to take their own life than women, and what that culture is and what that sort of process is, that's only going to help equality and help men to sort of be more emotional and not this sort of alpha beta figuring out where you are.
I think feminism in general realised that, as we, in intellectual and in practical ways, realising that gender is a construct and people, women are being given these expectations, these conditioning, but at the same time realising it wasn't balanced because that wasn't happening with men, because they didn't identify and they weren't seen as being oppressed. But exactly the same forces in equal measure are happening. And so actually I think that's why it's so, can be so female heavy.
That's so interesting, because you're talking about New Zealand, where Rose is from.
Thank you.
Don't have to clap.
Was the first country to have votes for women, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. God, we do a lot more.
It was in the 1800s. So
yes.
And I was wondering if you feel like that society, which is a really interesting mixed society.
No, we've still got toxic masculinity and bucket loads. No, is that the question? Sorry.
No, I was just wondering what that sort of early doors ideas of sort of gender equality of that, if the idea is that what Jack is saying, which I think is really true, that toxic masculinity is a target for both feminism and mental health advocates, because so much of our society pressures all sort of boil down onto people in that way. Do you feel like there's a difference between New Zealand and the UK?
No, in the sense that I think even more so, I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever met a man from New Zealand, but they are not very forthcoming with their emotions. but it is, I mean, I think it's actually something that it's kind of universal in the sense. I'm very distracted because I do have a question for Jack, because I think that's so interesting in the sense of hearing about that festival and hearing that more women go to it. And I'm just like, is there an embarrassment for, because my pet peeve is when a dude will go, ugh, men, right? And you're like, fuck you, you are a man, okay? Like, you are in a, you are part of the something, which I think, like, separating yourself from that is a way, but then not backing that up with how am I making myself a better person to, you know, it's just a weird, like, otherness to that. And is it because it's an embarrassment to accept that you have, like, have maybe some areas in which your life you can improve, which I think is a real thing that I think a woman often do, of self-reflection and going, how can I better myself? But I think for the men in my life anyway, I think there is a real reluctance to be like, have the humility to be like, I'm not stepping up in this regard in my life. I want to do something about it. I just so rarely hear that with guys, and I just, is that something to do, you reckon, with that?
I think it's, I'm not sure if it's got something to do with like selfishness or not. I often hear like a lot of my sort of, I think it's just a change, a lot of my, I do think sexuality plays into a slightly different hand. I'm not saying that like, there are historically times where gay men have been incredibly feminist and incredibly like, you know, not appropriate with the way that they depict women. But on the whole, I think in my sort of world, gay men tend to be a little bit more open and a little bit more empathetic. And it's the straight men that in my life that I like love and am mates with that I'm always sort of like having chats with. A recent sort of phenomenon that I found is like straight men who are like, well, you know, like I am a feminist.
But
like, as in, give it up for me. Yeah. Round of applause. And then being like, but you know, I should earn more. Like, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And like, there's, it's almost like men now understand, especially in light of sort of the Me Too campaign, I think more and more men are understanding there are issues that actually they are massively part of the solution of. Yeah. But like, it's almost...
I think that it's a very similar thing with white people and race, actually. I think it takes so much conversation to actually empathise with a point of view because we can't help it. We're in our own... our entire lives are spent looking from our very, very subjective worldview. And I think it very the reason that white people are so insulted to be called racist, because they think racists go along the street in vans shouting at anyone that's not white, whereas you do a lot more listening or a lot more studying, and then you realise it's much more insidious, and then you have to actually face up to, it's not as easy as saying, I'm not racist. Am I more likely to employ a white person than a black person and not even realise that's why I chose them? Then you have to start examining that. So it's not as easy as going, I'm a feminist, but this is what I still think, because then you go, oh, it's an ongoing process of bias and all the time and listening when I'm told that I'm wrong, and then and going, like, as an ape, we form a tribe, and it's stronger if we have someone or we have others outside of it. And now in the world, we live in this tribe of billions, and we have to keep unlearning that tribal behaviour.
But do you think, though, there's such a... I find that, though, and I mean, I should get off Twitter for sure, but, you know, that reluctance to accept that everyone is... So instead of... like, Twitter is basically people yelling at everyone else and not listening to people, which is, I think, so... I mean, so rarely do I see actual exchanges where people have listened to each other and learnt something. And when you see them, you're like, whoa, this is amazing. This is like 2008 Twitter. But it is... But do you feel, though, that, like, exactly the thing of, like, a white person who's like, I'm not racist, but it's like you do exhibit racist behaviour maybe in unknown ways, or you weren't intentional, but the... It's the defensiveness to go, when you're labelling something, like, to go, no, I'm not that, but not to accept that everyone's fucking up all, like, everyone's just always messing shit up. Yeah. And it's like, it's and so when you're, like, suddenly told, oh, well, I've done something that's not necessarily a feminist thing, that kind of thing of going, well, what do I do now? Do I have to return my badge I bought from, you know, paper chase?
Yeah,
you know?
An issue that I had in my last show... That I was operating on, that I was probably problematic gay man, that I had one of those moments where I had written a line where I was talking about my first day on a job being a primary school teaching assistant for this agency, and me talking about going in there and feeling really confident, but wearing like a very tight blazer that made me very like top heavy. And I said something that in the gay world, this word is used almost in a sort of like glamorized complimentary way. I was like, I felt really slutty. And then I ended it like Jane McDonald on a cruise ship. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, I like looked into what I'd actually just said and was like, hold on a second. That's a really negative word that I'm using to describe something. If I'd have said, which I later did change it to, I only said it once, which I was like, I feel really sexy, like Jane McDonald on a cruise ship, because if anybody's watched any of Jane McDonald's documentaries, which I love, she's incredibly sexy and fucking brilliant on the cruise ships. But it was like, it's like noticing those little things and correcting and changing them when you've contextualized them as harmless, but you need to realize
language is incredibly important. And I think especially when we're talking about self-care, like the thing I think was so interesting at the beginning of this, so we all picked up different versions of what self-care means and the words and the language around feminism, especially since we now all like content, guys. I don't know if you know about content, but it's very good and you should have lots of it. And like there's this sense that, like, you know, this, we've got so many think pieces and all of this, it's this like machinery that's built, and Twitter is part of that, that's built around endless content that brings you to advertising. I mean, I know I sound like my aunt is so cynical. Twitter is basically my aunt having a political conversation in that she is waiting to speak. And like, it doesn't matter what you say, because 2 minutes before she thought of something good and she is about to say it. So you could have moved on. You could be like, and that's why I don't know about Brexit. And she's like, but the real thing about Canadian politics is, and she's like, she's there. But like, we do live in this world where there's lots of opinions. And I think coming back to the self and understanding where the self fits into that is really key. And I sort of wanted to end by thinking about language and how we use it, especially as performers. Do you, like, the thing that I do that I want to change about myself is that I sometimes hear myself saying, she's crazy. Just like very casual. And what you mean is, I don't know how to describe her. Yeah. She's confident, or she's loud, or she's all these things. You could describe her, but there's like this unpredictable.
I think it's quite often. I have the same thing. I have the same thing. I love the word loopy. Describing someone like, an absolute, like, so loopy, and because for me it's a really fun word, and again realizing its connotations, and what I mean is you don't know what she's going to say next.
And we have this thing as a tradition. I don't think I've ever called a guy crazy in a fun way. Like, I think if I'm calling a guy crazy, it's because I'm worried. That guy is crazy. It's like I call my friends crazy all the time. Oh, she's crazy. You know, like, we have these like understandings about how we see women as sort of women first and the labels that we put on them. And guys, we're coming to the end of the time. I sort of wanted to talk briefly about how you see yourself, like, very individually within gender roles. And like something that I find really exciting, and we haven't talked about it, and there's so much more to talk about, like when people talk about gender identity and when people talk about being trans and they talk about the way that they see themselves, I am so excited to live in a world where people can say that they are the sex that they feel that they are, that they know that they scientifically are, because for me, in the most privileged way possible, which is why I don't understand why people have problems with it, like, from the most privileged middle-class way, that means that I also get to think about that. I also get to change the landscape of what it means
to be
a woman.
They're teaching us what gender is.
Yeah.
And not through choice, because they have the most difficult journey. And actually, in terms of ideology and language, it's a hugely generous thing for cis people who haven't had to consider certain things so much. I've been reading so many autobiographies, and I'd recommend everyone does this, about people through their transitioning process. And they're all obviously so different, like any autobiography. It's just as different as anything else. But because them working out what gender is and where they sit within it, they a little bit like someone who has to come out as gay, actually, in the same way, you have to really consider who you are, and then you have to go through this journey of defining people. The thing about cis is it's quite lazy for a lot of us. It is to do with kind of clothes and who you're best friends with, and then it, and if you're straight as well as sexuality.
And how people talk to you in the street. Like, it often comes down to very sort of shallow things that we don't consider, I think is what you're saying.
What's interesting for me is I always saw being male as a very positive thing. And when I was scared, from childhood onwards, I would pretend I was a man. And part of my feminism in later life has been trying to find a way of thinking that's womanhood. Because even through my 20s, being nervous, no, just pretend you're a man and go in there. How would a man behave in this situation? How would they get what they want? Rather than thinking that's a form of womanhood, I've always had this thing where men deserve it. So I think it's, so that idea
that's
of like who you are.
And where you sit. And I think that's a really interesting thing about how we now think about feminism. Like, we, for a long time, striving towards equality meant striving to being exactly like the ideal of man.
When I was at school, when I was growing up, and there is part of East London, which was very racist, and the whole way of not being racist was pretending you didn't notice what colour anyone was. And actually, that's not racist. But you'd pretend you had... Is she black? she never. She had it. So I didn't like. And I think very similarly that then when happened that was a move. That was one of the waves of feminism. Was I want to get paid the same as my male colleague, so I will try and behave in a way which doesn't let anyone know that I have a family at home.
And it's also the myth of exceptionalism, because it means some people can get through that gap. Like, some women do, like, you know, female CEOs, this, that. I can't remember her name. She has 4 children. And if I see her picture.
Oh, she's at the Yahoo one or something.
That's Marissa Myers. She has 1 child. This is a British, I know all the CEO's children. She has 1 child. Incredible. She's happy. She doesn't need more. But no, this is a British exec who has 4 children, maybe 5 children. And she, I think she's called Ruth. That's all I got. She called Ruth, and she just, in every article, I'm like, as I turn the page, I'm like, there's going to be a picture of Ruth. And there she is, smiling with her 4 children and her 2 nannies. Like, she is having, like, and she's honest about it, but there is this idea that we sort of strive to be in this one way. And Rose and Jack, do you think you sit, just to finish, do you think you sit in traditional gender roles? Do you think, how do they work for you?
I mean, I guess one thing what you actually said before about the use of language, and especially like when you're talking about like trans stuff and like what can be isolating, especially when you're watching something like stand up. My last show, I've got a lot of stuff about, obviously, like being I'm a person, I'm a woman who talks about stuff about being a woman and things that are different between men. Very groundbreaking stuff in comedy. But I really started thinking a lot about how I want to go ahead in comedy with the way in which I speak about groups. Because when I speak about women in my stand-up, I kind of go, in my mind, I'm like, well, this is as woman, but anyone who identifies as a woman or as, it's, you know, or who wants to, basically, I imagine it as anyone who wants to throw their hat in the ring of being a woman, then I'm talking to you and I'm talking about you. And so it's hard with comedy because it is, but it's really tricky with comedy because with comedy, it's like you are boiling something down into its simplest form and the quickest form in which you can articulate that. And so sometimes things slip through the gaps in which you're going, I feel like maybe I'm isolating with the language that I'm using here, put certain people in the audience who are watching, and I'm trying to make a more active effort.
And I think it gets easier. And I think sometimes we feel told off because it's someone else telling us, but I think you can find a succinct way to do it. In my last show, I've got the thing about periods. And when I was first doing it, I was saying, of course, men can understand periods. And I realized, of course, I'm talking about as if biology is gender. And then I changed it. And first of all, I was really confident. And of course, not all women have periods. And I was trying to do this whole... And then I just started saying, of course, people who don't have periods can recognize them. And then no one's like, we know what you mean. You're not excluding people.
Totally.
And people
that's
who didn't feel excluded anyway.
The word there, you know, people are always like, there was a professor who was like, I won't call my student there. And you're like, there's a very interesting thing that they said, okay, so describe your friend who's over in the room, like, oh, well, they are tall. And you're like, all of them? Like, what? Like, we do use this language already. It's fascinating to think about how I think these conversations often boil down to things that we don't think about in terms of ourselves fitting into these wider contexts of communities and feminism.
Yeah.
I think I have like the it's a bizarre one because I sort of feel like I tend to not relate that much to many other men. Class for me is the biggest section where I go into it. So I feel like a working class man, but I feel like a middle class person. Like a lot of the time I feel like when I'm going about my daily life, I'm a middle class person experiencing the benefits of it. And then I'll sort of like go back home or I'll be with like family members and I become a working class man with all the chips on my shoulder and all the sort of like sometimes really horrible aggressive streaks that I don't like. And then middle class person sometimes tells me off when I shout over my mum, but then working class man is like, I'm angry. And like, the two of them are having like a fight and it's bizarre. And then there's like some gay guys sort of wandering around somewhere. Like, yeah. And so it's a bizarre one because I think actually the more I'm sort of growing up and, you know, this year I turned 25 and I'm like, okay, you need to know a little bit more sure of who you are. I find that gender for me feels more, even more apparent when I go back to my roots. And when I look at the differences that are there between my nieces and my nephews, and I look at how we're a weird family. I've got like great nephews because I'm like the only one that hasn't had a child yet. And like the way that my nephew Vinny is told like not to cry because of it being like a girl. And I'm like, wow, because I read so much stuff in my other life in London where I'm a performer where people just really click into that really quickly, but it's still so apparent. I'm not trying to say that all working class people are like that. That's not it. But it's something that I see. And the actual thing that I worry about the most is my mum's generation. My mum's generation of women are the ones that I feel are the most invisible and most forgotten. And they're not even like really marketed to in the same way. They're marketed to still in the very basic principles, but like self-care hasn't even hit them yet. That industry's not even gone there. Like even Yankee Candles aren't for them. Like, and that's the sort of generation I'm most interested in. And I think that's why I think the best thing that I can be as a man is as connected to my mum as possible, as connected to what she's going through and the things and the challenges that she has. And even like the admin, I think last time I came on here, I spoke about my mum being a widow and having to remind people every single time a gas bill comes up or she's on the phone or like that being her classification. And even though we've both gone through that grief, I can be whoever I want now, but she's always a widow. There is a word for her. And that's something that I hope that like as long as I can keep my relationship with her, I can try and change or try and, oh, this sounds like I'm like going to be a warrior for widows, but try and change things. And that's my 2019 Edinburgh Fringe show.
Start your own clap, start your own clap.
But yeah, so I think that's it. Is actually the more dialogue we can have across age and across class, the better I think gender roles will be, and the better that we can have more equality, I think.
Thank you. I mean, that's a wonderful place to end. I mean, it's beautiful. And also, I think really interesting because we started talking about how community is the thing, that self-care is important, but self-care isn't just like, so I'm going to use the word solipsistic. Is that correct? Someone?
No. Solipsistic is believing nothing exists outside of your own mind.
Ah, yes. Of course. To use was onanism, but I think onanism
is masturbation.
Is a masturbation.
Yeah, it's from the
which
Bible.
Is of course what everyone thought we were talking about today when I said self-care, but we didn't get to it. I was going to ask, maybe. We have run out of time.
Oh, wow.
So as always, there's so many things we didn't quite get to cover. Masturbation. Do I know what words mean? No, I really don't. And so there's so much to do with self-care and finding yourself within that. So I hope this isn't the end of the conversation for you. I hope you keep talking about it because I think there's still so much more. And I'm sure you each individually have had things that you've been thinking about. You guys have been wonderful. You guys have been fantastic. So let's join me in clapping the wonderful Sarah Pascoe, Rose Magifeo and Jack Rich.
So, are we any closer to finding out what women want? Does a bear shit in the woods? I don't know, I'm not a farmer. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, subscribe and share. It makes such a difference in my ongoing journey to top Mel Gibson when you Google what women want. Thank you to producer Zach Annette and to radio legend Shola Aleje for her help. Music is by The Artisans via Jamendo Publishing. What Women Want is going to Edinburgh. We're going to be at the Pleasance for 6 dates only, Saturdays and Sundays in August 2019. Please go to the Pleasance website to get your tickets. I would love to see you there.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.